Good morning, listeners. Welcome to Christ Today on KKXX. Today we have with us Jim Brochiers, who is involved with emergency situations, and we're going to discuss the situation of the Oroville Dam. And first, let's just give a little prayer. Heavenly Father, we give you thanks for this day, for the understandings that we have, and the many blessings in life that we have through you, through Jesus Christ, and we pray in Jesus' name, and amen. Jim Brochiers, welcome to the program. We are so curious about what's going on at the Oroville Dam and all the water situation.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me. And shed what light I can. I'm not the biggest expert on all of these issues, but I know a lot about emergency preparedness and activities having to do with response to emergencies. So we can talk about that and see if we can shed some light on this issue, and especially shed some light on how we as citizens can be better prepared.
And that is wonderful. The Oroville Dam situation is so current. It is right around us, so it brings the situations of emergency preparedness and just our awareness right in front of us. That's my hope for today.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great opportunity because people will, at least for a window of time, you know, they'll get it, meaning it'll be a lot resonate with people that preparedness is a current activity and that there are things that you can do to prepare yourself and that there are activities that can occur like this that come out of nowhere, seemingly out of nowhere. And you think all is good and you go through life not prepared for this type of an emergency, and then it occurs and you go, gee, I wish I'd been better prepared. So we can talk about ways that people can be prepared and the unique nature of this emergency, which is the largest evacuation in Northern California history. So it's not something that has happened, but we've done some pretty large evacuations due to wildland fires and flooding in the past. So, we've seen this type of threat before. We've just never had it be this catastrophic of a potential.
Yes. With the water, we've had fire situations also, and there have been evacuations for both of these.
Yeah, we've had, in Paradise, we had nearly 10,000 people evacuated two different times in 2008, so that's a pretty big number. In 96, 97, probably close to this amount of people were evacuated over the course of the flooding that occurred up and down the valley, the levees that failed, a lot of area was evacuated. So there was a similar, but not quite as large, I believe, evacuation that occurred in 96, 97.
Yeah. Well, it has affected so many people. Why did this ever happen?
That's a really complicated question. It's going to take a long time to unravel, but let's just say, without looking at the why these things happen, we can talk about what happened.
Yes, let's do that.
And what happened was that Oroville Dam was built or filled in the 60s as a project, part of the California Water Project. It's managed by Department of Water Resources, and it was built as a water storage unit for the purposes of use downstream and as a flood control measure. So it has both those purposes built into it. When we talk about flood control, then we bring in another agency, the Army Corps of Engineers, who maintains and manages the flood control systems of Northern California, and that includes dams and levees. Army Corps has a role in the management of the releases from the dam during winter, but primarily is managed by Department of Water Resources. So this year we had a phenomenal amount of rainfall in both October again and again in January. We had a lot of snowfall, above normal snowpack in the hills, and that has set the stage like it did in 96-97 for a series of storms to come in that are very warm. And when a series of storms that are warm comes in and the snow levels go way up high, in this case up around 8,000 feet, which means that you get a combination of rain falling up to 8,000 feet and snow melt falling at up to that level. The lake, and again, I'm talking as a layman in a lot of ways, but an emergency manager for a long time, and I'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
The lake has a design capacity, and they maintain a buffer, let's call it.
Like, yes.
They don't let the lake get over, normally, over a certain level to the top, so that when there's a significant event where water will surge into the lake, they know it'll go up. They won't be able to necessarily control it using their normal outflows, but they have that buffer built in. So the complicating factor here, that on top of a phenomenal storm, amount of input into the reservoir, huge amounts of water coming into the reservoir, is that the spillway had the large hole that developed in it.
Yes.
And so they were concerned about the spillway and shut down some of the flows that would have been used to maintain the buffer. And that allowed the lake during this phenomenal inflow to rise rapidly. And it rose to the point of overtopping the emergency spillway for the first time in the history of the dam. So we'd never seen, you know, Oroville's emergency spillway spill before. I'm, again, not an engineer, and I'm not an expert on flows. I know that the design capacity was far higher than the level at which they saw issues developing below the dam that caused them to say, we have concerns that this could cause erosion that might cause a breach in the emergency spillway. And that doesn't mean a catastrophic failure of the dam. It means that a certain level of the emergency spillway portion could fail. And so let's just say, for the sake of discussion, that that's about 30 feet. 30 feet of the top 30 feet of the reservoir would go pouring through an opening.
Yes.
That was that kind of thinking that resulted in the decision to evacuate.
Yeah.
Because of that concern, because they had that concern that erosion might be happening and weren't able to tell right at the moment how much damage had occurred, if any, and whether that damage was going to be catastrophic or not. But when you talk about the amount of people that are below that water and the potential for a 30-foot wall of water, which was what was released publicly, was there by the sheriff, Sheriff Honey, who's done an outstanding job of decision-making, in my opinion. Yes, he evacuated a lot of people, and they got to go home, and there was no failure. But the consequences on the other side of that coin were, had the failure occurred and you not moved the people out, he could have killed tens of thousands of people. It would have been one of the greatest catastrophes in United States history.
Hmm.
So, yes, I mean, I certainly understand where Chief Honey made the decision, or Sheriff Honey made the decision to evacuate, and I fully support, you know, those decisions. But that was sort of the perfect storm, you might say, that those, the cross of this amazing amount of input caused by a snowpack combined with a warm rainstorm combined with a problem developing on the spillway.
Mm-hmm.
Time will tell. I'm not going to even begin to speculate today. It serves no purpose to speculate on why the hole developed. I will say this, though, and this is kind of an interesting side story.
Yeah.
To this whole thing, and it came out today. I've been telling people for days because I happen to be knowledgeable, or at least have read about, the failure at Glen Canyon Dam in 1983, which had a lot of similarities to it. They had a massive inflow from a massive storm occurring in a large watershed of the Colorado River. We're talking about Glen Canyon Dam and Lake Powell. Lake Powell was, they were concerned that it was going to fill up and overtop Lake Powell. they were using the emergency spillways or the spillways that are bored into the sides of the dam, and started kicking out big rocks, big chunks of concrete. Sound familiar?
Well, yes.
Well, if it doesn't, it sounds familiar because it's the same phenomenon they think may have happened. We don't know that for sure. It'll take a while for the engineers to analyze what happened at the spillway in Oroville, but it's a process called cavitation. And what happens is that a small obstruction in a smooth concrete area, and again, I'm talking here, I am a layman talking like I'm an engineer. I don't want anybody to believe I'm an engineer, but this is what was described in the book, that that the downstream from that, it causes air bubbles to form. So air bubbles in this case are like little pebbles. They're hard, and they're rolling and rotating in turbulence. So that turbulence eats away at any flaw or any place in the concrete. So downstream from a very small obstruction, you get this cavitation. The cavitation causes the concrete to fail. And it's interesting because in today's paper, I'd read about the device they've since Glen Canyon's failure. Glen Canyon didn't fail. Let me reiterate that. They did the same kind of things here. They managed the flows. They actually added some height to the reservoir for a temporary period of time so they could inspect the tunnel. A lot of similarities when you start thinking about, they had to look at the, they're doing what they're doing now. They're evaluating. They're trying to evaluate while they're flowing water. In this case, they shut down the flows in the tunnel that was kicking out the bigger hunks of concrete at Glen Canyon Dam. Went inside and inspected and found these holes, five holes that had developed inside of the spillway, the tube. So what they've learned since then is engineers have developed, I think they're called aerators, which are devices that cushion the impact of air bubbles and reduce the amount of energy. Because it's basically, think about it this way. There's a lot of energy that gets concentrated in a single place. And that energy is so concentrated, and there's so much of it, that if it finds any avenue, it starts taking apart what you built. So the idea behind, these systems that we have is we're dissipating energy. The dam is a method of dissipating energy. There's energy in that water. That water has weight, and it has head, they call it, or height. And when it flows out, it has energy. Flood control is a method of energy dissipation. You hold that energy back and release it when it's desirable to release it, so that you don't end up with downstream flooding. So it really is, a lot of the story here is about energy dissipation. And so we're talking about what happened. So then, like I said, consequently, in Glen Canyon Dam's case, they were able to learn from it. And I hope, if they do find that there's cavitation here, maybe apply similar types of techniques to Oroville Spillway. But again, I'm not an engineer. The engineers will work all that out. People who have a lot more pay grade than I do will be working on this problem, and I'm confident that they'll come up with some solutions. And I hope that politically we will support those solutions with funding, because whether there are major flaws or minor flaws or whatever in the dam, obviously there's some things that should be done to rectify what happened so that it doesn't happen again. That said, because in 96-97 we had, I would say, a similar circumstance. We had the same thing. We had a snowpack develop in December, and then we had a late December rainstorm, early January rainstorm that came in at Pineapple Express, as I like to call them, or Tropical Express, a very warm storm, melted off a lot of snow, caused really high flows, resulted in the evacuation of downtown Oroville, not as wide of an area in that case. And then ultimately there were some levee failures, and so there was actual flooding. Where this event hasn't resulted in significant flooding, there has definitely been flooding. There are places downstream that, because of the high flows, the low areas are flooded. But there hasn't been significant flooding. But in that case, because of the levee failures, populated areas were flooded. So in 96, 97, we actually had damage. We had homes damaged by flooding and lost to flooding damage because of levee failures. So this time the levee system is holding. It looks like there was a failure this last week in one of the levees, and they're working on that and getting it taken care of, but not a more general failure of the levees. That said, the potential here was more catastrophic, meaning short term.
Yeah.
If that had occurred, if the 30-foot wall of water had come down, who knows what would have failed. I mean, I think that would have been a chain of events. We call it, you know, cascading effects. One effect causes another effect. So that causes levees to fail, and that causes other areas to flood and other road closures. And that explains the larger area that was evacuated.
Yeah.
Marysville, Yuba City, you know, Yuba and Sutter County, areas that were, that they chose to evacuate because the downstream effect, first of all, they would mm-hmm. feel that water in their floodplains, but then there's also the huge potential of secondary failures of the system that would have impacted even a wider area.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you could safely say we dodged a bullet this time. You know, we didn't end up with the widespread impacts that could have happened, and I think it was very proactive, and I compliment again our emergency responders. And this is a point where I'd really like to say something about our county. Our emergency responders, sheriff, CAL FIRE, local fire departments, Oroville, City of Oroville, police and fire, Public Works, Caltrans, I think they did a bang-up job. I think they did an excellent job of managing this. And then on top of that, even showing more pride for our community is our community stepped up big time. You know, our churches, our Azad's martial arts, you know, I mean, people opened their doors, people delivered food, people delivered water, people delivered clothes. The outpouring of help was phenomenal. It's hard to manage sometimes. It's a challenge.
Yes.
But the fact is that you love to see that your community cares. Yeah. And when people are displaced and, you know, distraught, that people are willing to step up and make a difference. So, you know, when we have these types of things, it tests our resolve and it tests our mm-hmm. training and our preparedness. And I think, I believe, and from my opinion, and I'll talk a little bit about now about who I am, that we passed that test in terms of preparedness, that there are certainly things we could have done better. And I think that the citizenry will understand better now what they need to do as individuals to be prepared. So my background is I started as a firefighter in 1971, and I worked a 40-year career as a firefighter. I retired as the Town of Paradise's fire chief. I've continued to work since I retired in 2006 as a coordinator for the Town of Paradise's Emergency Operations Center, and I worked this last week in the Emergency Operations Center. I'll talk more about emergency operations here in just a minute, we do. I continue to teach Incident Command System, which is a system on how to manage emergencies. It's been around, developed in California in the early 70s, and now after 911, it became a part of the National Incident Management System. So mm-hmm. it is a national system, and I teach that to communities all over Northern California, so that they can be better prepared, so they have the tools that they need to have community-level preparedness. And I have other irons in the fire. I work with the Butte County Fire Safe Council, and we do things that are mitigation measures for wildland fire. So mm-hmm. we prepare for evacuations. We train and educate people on how to be prepared for evacuations and how to make their home more defendable during a wildland fire. We manage grants to put in fuel reduction projects around communities. Right now, we're just starting on a fairly large scale, $200,000 project around the Paradise Pines area in Magalia. And we basically work with all the local government agencies to try to make it so that people are prepared and communities are prepared for wildland fire in particular. That particular mm-hmm. agency is very specific to wildland fire, but it has a lot of carryover in other areas. So my background as a fire chief, I've been able to help manage floods. I've been involved in earthquakes, wildland fires, structure fires, technical rescues, which is a category that got a lot of use this last week that maybe was people didn't hear about. But during the response, a lot of people ended up in water. And technical rescue means a kind of rescue that requires technical skills. And we are fortunate in this county to have a couple of really amazing organizations, one of which is the Butte County Interagency Rescue Group. It's a multi-agency team that trains and has standards and standards of equipment and standards of care. And when you have a water rescue, it's very specialized. You have to have very specialized tools, and you have to have very specialized training. And probably a lot of people weren't aware that quite a few water rescues occurred in the last week, because as they released more water into the reservoir, people who were in lower areas got caught, or in some cases make bad choices of going into areas where there are standing water or moving water, and then we have to send a team in to get them out. So we had quite a few of those types of rescues. We actually at one point had numerous teams staged that were brought in as state resources, technical rescue teams, water rescue teams, in case of the catastrophic failure of the dam. So that just shows you the kind of behind the scenes kind of things that are going on.
And I've never heard of them.
Yeah.
Well, I've heard of the teams, but I never heard of them being deployed in the in this event.
Yeah, if you were listening to the radio, to the, let's say, the Butte County Fire Radio channel, you would have heard numerous rescues that occurred during this past week. So they were busy. They were busy. And that's not unexpected during a high water event of any kind. But the potential for the amount of water that would be flowing down the river was tremendous. So they brought in, like I said, some standby teams in case that event occurred, because it was going to catch people off guard. We know that there are people who chose not to evacuate.
Yes.
Those people would have been being swept downstream, and eventually, if they were still able to be rescued, we would send teams in with boats or specialized equipment to get them.
Is it land-based rescue, or is it helicopter rescue, or both?
It's a combination. It's actually land, boat, and helicopter.
Yeah.
So we have a rule. It's kind of a fun one to remember, but a saying that we use in water rescue, it's called, it's basically call, reach, throw, go, helo. So the idea is to do it the least dangerous way, right? So you're going to call out to them to come to you if you can, so you don't have to get in water. That's the first level. But if that's not going to work, then you can reach to them with something like a stick or a rope.
Yeah.
And if you have to, then you go. And we actually put swimmers in the water with proper PFDs, personal flotation devices, and helmets, sometimes tethered. Tethering is a very dangerous thing. So whenever you put somebody in the water but you want to hang on to them, there's always a risk that the tether that you're using to control them will get tangled in something and pull them underwater.
So you have
to have equipment that allows you to be on tether but release yourself from the tether. So that just shows you the level of, sophistication that you have to have. If you're going to go into a moving water, let's say a car is 15 feet from the shore, and there's people in it. There's moving water between you and that vehicle. Well, if they can't, you don't want them to come to you in that case, because they don't have flotation devices on. So if they get swept away in the water, they're not going to float. So if we can, we'll throw a rope over and send them flotation devices so they can put on some protection. Then we'll send a swimmer out, and the swimmer will help guide them back to the shore while they're on this rope that he can release, because he's got a pull, basically like a parachute pull, that allows him to release himself should they get tangled. So that's the swim. And the go could be either as a swimmer or a boat. So we have numerous boats in this county that we use, different kinds of boats depending on the water. It could be a raft. It could be on a speedboat on the Sacramento River. Depending on, it could be a wave runner, a watercraft, personal watercraft. So we have all that equipment, and all the people who are on that team are trained in that equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately, last but not least, I'll say, is the helo.
Mm-hmm.
Helicopters rescue. We train in helicopter rescues, and we're prepared to do helicopter rescues. So conditions may not allow the helicopter to fly, high winds, heavy storm conditions, but they are a great tool when you need them. But each level increases the risk to the rescuers.
Yes.
Helicopters can be very safely done, but they, any operation in the air has got some risk associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one example of the many ways that we prepare as a community. We prepare by having shelters. We prepare by having emergency response training. This county, I'm going to say that I know for a fact, has done a lot of training, in particular since the fires of 2008. And they've, the county government and places like the Town of Paradise continually train their personnel on emergencies. They do exercises. They have tabletop sessions. They work through the different things that could happen. Because when this happens, you can imagine it can become very chaotic very quickly. And in this case, here's a unique twist for you. They felt the need to move because of the water levels and the flooding of Oroville. The EOC, County's Emergency Operations Center, would normally be in Oroville. But they moved it to Chico, which means that not only did they have to open, but they had to open in a new place. So they opened in Chico's Emergency Operations City of Chico's Emergency Operations Center. Again, back to those partnerships of government. Chico did an outstanding job, City of Chico, in supporting that EOC, providing some fire staff and other staff to guide and help them work, both work physically in a new facility and provide some expertise and experience. I was meeting down there the other day. I had a talk with Chief Division Chief Aaron Lowe from Chico, and he was doing a great job supporting their operation by giving them some technical advice on how to make things happen. While this may not be the most important topic to the public, it is in a way, because it's important not only that we respond and that we meet the needs of our citizens, not only important that we try to find ways to help them get through this this stressful tragedy or potential tragedy, but we also have to be fiscally responsible. And in this case, because it's a disaster declaration, there's a opportunity to be reimbursed for all these extra costs that are being incurred by the county and cities. And so if you want to be reimbursed, you, number one, have to file a disaster declaration, which they've done. But you have to have very clear paperwork that shows the cost and the relationship between the cost and the disaster in order to be reimbursed.
By the federal?
Yeah, if you're going to present this to FEMA, let's say, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, if you're going to present a bill to FEMA, you better have copious documentation that you incurred this cost as a result of the disaster. And if you don't, you won't get paid. So a lot of extra money gets spent during these things, as you can imagine. We were housing, emergency managers were housing, you know, I'm going to say somewhere at peak, somewhere between around 2,500 people in shelters. I can't tell you the total number of shelters, because it was really big at one time, and then they started consolidating them down. Paradise had a shelter, an overnight shelter at the CMA Church that had almost 300 people by the time they sent the people down the hill to other supported shelters in the Chico area, five shelters that were being supported in the Chico area. And then animals. We have another bang-up organization. I mean, just total kudos to the North Valley Animal Disaster Group, which is a volunteer group of citizens who trains to help people during emergencies by taking care of their animals. And I don't mean just pets. I mean largest animals, cows, horses, sheep, pigs, llamas, and right down to snakes and lizards and parakeets and dogs and cats, of course, being the top two. And they housed hundreds of animals during this last week, and probably still are housing some animals, because people who maybe don't want to move large animals, for example, back to, you know, not knowing, they're still in a warning. They've been had the order, evacuation order lifted, but they're still in a warning. So maybe not a good idea to move your cows and horses back into an area that's still under warning. So they may still be housing animals as we speak. But this is all volunteer organization. Buchanan Sheriff Search and Rescue. They provide some of that technical rescue I'm talking about. All volunteer organization working under the sheriff's office. So we've got these outstanding organizations within both our paid professional corps of volunteers, of responders, and our volunteer responders, who prepare all year round for all different types of emergencies. And when these emergencies come together, they're managed through the county's or a local emergency operations center. And that's kind of become one of my areas of expertise.
For the materials that they use, do they have a support from certain agencies? Is it a local or a federal agency that helps with them?
In a small-scale emergency, there's more than one answer to that question. Yeah. In a small-scale emergency, it comes out of the pocket of the local government who's providing that support, whether it's, let's say, the town of Paradise or City of Chico or Butte County.
Yeah.
On a larger scale, where there's like this, where there's a potential for a disaster declaration, yes, by the governor and the president, it's likely that 80% of the cost of the expenditures will be reimbursed through FEMA. So a lot of it's donated. A lot of material gets donated. Like the water, they were getting huge amounts of water. The Red Cross, county government, were getting huge amounts of water donated by stores, individuals, businesses. So all of that's free, of course, because it's being donated. And any other goods and materials that are being donated are free. But there, of course, are costs. Mm-hmm. And those costs, again, could be borne by the local government, depending on the scale of the emergency, or they could be borne in large part by the disaster fund, you might say, the emergency fund of California, or FEMA's disaster fund.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it varies from, like the Saddle Fire, for example, this last year was not a disaster declaration. So the cost associated with doing whatever we had to do, we evacuated areas, and there was some sheltering, not a lot, but the cost of running those operations was not reimbursed. So that comes out of the pocket of the local governments that are managing the emergency at the time.
One of the things I like to acknowledge is the good job that everyone did. And there's a lot of people who will say, we didn't have to do that. Why did we go to all that trouble? However, look at the amount of, well, nobody had very serious loss of anything in this situation. And I think it's important to acknowledge the people who have worked so diligently to make things happen. And they have.
I totally agree. I think, you know, when I look at what all those agencies I talked about and what all of our citizens did.
Citizens too, yes.
That to help people, to make this work better for the people who were affected, it was huge.
It's huge. It was huge.
Huge,
yeah,
amount of work, a huge amount of effort, a huge amount of giving. And I'm, like I said before, I'm proud of our county. I'm proud of our responders. I'm proud of our citizens. You know, I think DWR, Department of Water Resources, right now might have an image problem. But I think one of the things they're going to say in the end was that while it was a lot of things didn't go well, the flood system did work ultimately.
Yes, it did.
It was challenged, and I'm not defending them or accusing them. I'm just saying that the system, we all can agree that the system was seriously challenged.
Yes.
But one of the purposes of that reservoir is that if the inflow had occurred that was building up the level of the dam and there were no dam, there would have been widespread flooding because it was a lot more than their peak release.
Yes.
It was more than their peak release. And their concerns was that it was even going to be higher. So if it had, let's say that they reached an inflow of 200,000 cubic feet per second and there were no dam there, that's how much would be flowing down stream.
Yes.
There would be more flooding as a result of that. So I think it'll be safe to say that some things should come out of this to improve the safety of Oroville Dam. I think, I think I'm fair in saying that there needs to be some efforts to make Oroville Dam a safer flood control dam. But that said, at least it helped. I mean, in terms of the long-term flooding control, it's doing right now, as we speak, what it's supposed to be doing again. It kind of had a window of time where it really wasn't, and they were on the edge of losing control of the flow of water. But hopefully, lessons will be learned from this that allow us to improve our safety in the future. But that kind of brings us to the other part we were talking about earlier, John, and that is personal preparedness.
Yes.
I think if you asked 35,000 people in Oroville how many of them felt that they were adequately prepared, I think it's fair to say that a good number of them would say that they really weren't adequately prepared for this type of an event. And I think if you ask that same number of people, how many would be more prepared next time, that a pretty fair percentage of them would say, I'll be better prepared next time. It often takes us an emergency to recognize that we need to prepare. So, you know, we always say that there's every emergency, a fire, a flood, an earthquake, has a life in which the takeaway lessons are applied. And then the further you get from the emergency, the less prepared you are. I think that's a pretty fair human, human nature comment, right?
Yes, it is.
So when's the last time the city of Oroville had to evacuate? Well, 96, 97, a portion of Oroville evacuated. My guess would be, and I'm just totally guessing, that the people who were in that evacuation area were probably a little better prepared than the people who had never been evacuated before. That said, I think everyone in the affected area now is rethinking their evacuation preparedness. And I think the number one thing that you can do for this rapid, large-scale evacuation is a go bag. So a go bag is basically that bag you grab that has the essential things that will help make your life easier. And that includes things like, grabbing the go bag. You may have to build your go bag, but you know what goes in it. So you make sure you have money so that you can buy stuff when you get away. You might want to have your personal hygiene stuff, but certainly you want to have your prescription.
Yes.
And so we ran into that, of course, where people, of course, left without their prescriptions. So you gather as part of this quick leave, this 5-minute out the door thing. You gather on your list that's in your go bag. Mm-hmm. What isn't already in the go bag, which could be all your personal hygiene stuff, can already be in it all the time. A change of clothes, some bottled water, because you might be in that long line waiting, and the stress is going to make you thirsty, and whatever you leave in it all the time. And then the list of things you'll throw in, your phone, make sure your cell phone check. I got my cell phone. I've got my money.
Yeah.
I've got my prescriptions. And the same thing for your pets. You want to get their essentials. Mm-hmm. They have prescriptions. You just grab some food for them, because they, you might be in a parking lot for a while, taking care of your animal.
Yes.
And you may or may not have access to a store, depending on the circumstances. So there's these essential items and a lot of it's individual. There's some generic things that I would say, everybody should consider. And you can go online and look up go bag online, and you can get a ton of different versions of go bags. But as my good friend Ruth Handelman, who works with us in the Parrish Ridge Fire Safe Council, she has the nickname the Bag Lady, because she goes around and gives speeches about go bags. And what she'll tell you is that go bags are very individual to your needs. If you're going to have to jump out the door and go, what is it you're going to miss when you realize you didn't have it?
Yes.
That's what needs to go on the list. That's the items that you're going to, the items you say, I wish I had taken, write it down right now and start your list. Because everything you wish you'd taken should be part of your go bag process.
For the pets, I've heard that a pet carrier is a good idea too. If you have your pet with you, and they are free to roam in the car, sometimes it's not so good.
Highly advise pet carriers for a couple reasons. One is it allows you a way to gather and control your animal.
Yes.
So let's say that we had a tragic case during the Concow fire in the year 2000, where we had a woman who was in an area where the fire was approaching, and we were evacuating that area, and engines were going in to help people evacuate and protect the structures. And this woman who had pets was trying to gather a dog and was unable to get it in control. If she'd had a carrier, she could put it in the carrier and carry it out.
Yes.
But it got out of her arms, went back in the house. The fire was approaching. The firefighter and her retreated into the house. The fire caught the house caught on fire from the wildland fire. And became smoky and hot. The firefighter tried to get her out the back window, but he was unable to do that. She was overcome by smoke, and he escaped with burns, and she perished in the fire. And, it's a good example of just a simple carrier, putting the dog at the very beginning when you're getting ready to evacuate. Yeah. It was a small animal. It could have been easily carried away in a carrier. And think about your cats. Cats don't like to be contained.
No, they
so
don't.
So you want to carry them in your arms, you might not get to the car.
Yes.
You know, if you put them in a, if you can get them in a crate, and you should, you know, train them to, if you get them in a crate, now you have control of that cat. Mm-hmm. So that's just a couple of examples of where it could actually be a life and death difference for you or for the animal.
Good example.
You know, that's why we highly advise that people use carriers whenever possible. You put it in the, you know, you put it in your car, you're under control. And like you said, now you've got maybe an animal that's used to being in a car and maybe one that you just don't normally take in your car. Now it's jumping all over the place and you got it in the back seat.
Yes.
And it's and you're in the middle of an evacuation in a giant traffic jam and you've got the confusion of a dog and your family and whoever else. Control is really important at that point. So and also helps a lot when you get to a destination. Because
that's true.
When you're there, you know, you've got the potential to have all these people with pets.
Oh, yeah.
And so now you've got another problem, you know, and most of the shelters, a shelter in itself doesn't tell, pets are not allowed inside of a Red Cross shelter, with the, I think, the exception of service dogs, service animals. So when you get to the Red Cross shelter, unless North Valley Animal Disaster Group has co-located, which they did in this case at the Silver Dollar Fairgrounds, a animal a shelter.
Nice.
If they do that, but not all of the shelters that were open had an animal shelter.
Yeah.
So you would have to leave your animal in the car.
Yeah.
So if you had to leave it in the car, it's much better to have a carrier.
Yes.
And if you have to turn them over to North Valley Animals Disaster Group, think about how much it's easier it is for them to control your animal if it's in a carrier. So let's say that in this case they were taking care of 200 animals.
200, yes.
Roughly 200 animals. Yeah. And that's a lot of animals. And it's a lot easier for them if you've provided them not only with the carrier and your pet, but any specialized food that you might have for your pet. Let's say your dog has a special diet. You know, again, that's part of your go bag.
Or whatever. Whatever they're used to.
Or medications, you know, so that they'll eat under the stress of the situation and maintain their health. We know how close. We've learned difficult lessons, the case in Concal being one, but we've learned some difficult lessons over the years that people are attached to their animals to the point of risking their lives. So we get that. I mean, people, that is their loved one, that is a family member. And so if it is that valuable to you, if that is that family member to you, then treat it as a family member.
Yeah.
Give it the respect, your animal, your pet, the respect it deserves by preparing for it as well.
With its own go bag,
for instance. Go bag.
Yeah.
It's doggy go bag or it's cat go bag or whatever it is, so that you're prepared. If they are that important, and they are,
Then
be prepared. Prepare for them. That's your job as a pet owner, is to prepare for them. And that, you know, again, brings us back to that level of personal preparedness that we discussed. The go bag is one aspect. The other is the shelter in place side. So let's say that you were just trapped because you were on a place that couldn't get out. You know, flooding occurs, whatever. That's where the 72-hour recommendation from Red Cross and other preparatory agencies come from, that you should have at least 72 hours of food and water in your home in case you really can't go anywhere. And I'll give you an example of that. We had the snowstorm in Paradise in 1990, the snow was so thick that unless you had a off-road type four-wheel drive, you weren't going to get out on your driveway and onto the road. There was no way. So you were going to be trapped in your home for days, and that's what occurred. Electricity was out over almost the entire town. Most of the roads, the side roads were closed. The main roads were a challenge. I mean, they were a challenge to keep up with the main roads. And in that case, it was a shelter-in-place situation. You had to be prepared within your own space to survive the 72 hours at least.
Yeah.
And we ask people to be prepared. We hope that they're prepared. And when these things come up, we find out whether they are or aren't. And I can tell you that we got lots of phone calls from people that weren't.
Yeah.
I understand some of the things that happened, like they ran out of medication with, you know, just happened to get caught at the back end of a, and you know, you with medications, they won't give you more. You can't just go down and get an extra bit of medication.
No,
you can only get what they give you, right? So you might have got caught, you know, short because of something like that. But as far as food and water, we should all of us be prepared to survive on our own for up to 72 hours.
And what about warmth? Is this a part of the discussion also?
Yeah, it's a challenge for particularly the foothill region, where we have a lot of power outages and people move up from places that typically don't have power outages.
Oh, yes.
And they aren't used to that, and they have, say, an all-electric home. So when the power's out for 48 hours, they have no heat for 48 hours.
Yes.
In the case of, again, back to the snowstorm of 1990, we had places that were out of power for 10 days or more. Yeah. So it's always good to have some alternative source of safe heat. So that's where you have to be careful, because you don't want to put a space heater that burns a fuel that puts off carbon monoxide in a closed space.
Mm-hmm.
We've had many fatalities over the years from that. So you want to make sure that whatever heater you get, auxiliary heat you get, doesn't require venting, or that you build in some kind of venting for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, I would prefer that people have some form of heat that doesn't require electricity built into their home, but not everybody can do that. Yeah. You know, a fireplace. Fireplaces are so-so. Wood stoves are much better forms of heat in emergencies as a backup, I'd say. But there are other ways that you can look into for maintaining heat. But that's a big factor in our, particularly in our elder population or our fragile populations, whether they be because of illness. They're very susceptible to, you know, heat, loss of heat. And we ran into that in 1990, where we had to evacuate, you know, go in and get people out of their homes and take them to warming centers or shelters, primarily because they were freezing to death in their own home. And that was one of the times where we learned, or I learned personally, if you can't take care of the pet, a lot of times the people will choose to stay in their home and freeze.
Wow.
So.
Wow. That's big.
We, you know, that was a lesson I didn't comprehend, or I didn't predict would occur.
Yeah.
And when we started managing that, we realized that we either had to accommodate pets somehow, or there was a potential that people would choose not to go, because if their pets couldn't go to the shelter you were taking them to, then they weren't going to go.
With humans, with us people, we think about the warmth, and there's some pretty easy answers for the initial part, which is get some more clothes on. Wear two pairs of pants and as many clothes as you can.
Exactly.
And what about the pets? Is there an answer to that one?
Well, I think you would want to create an environment for them where you could, you know, bundle them up, you know, like in a dog-cat bed. But, you know, the animal has to cooperate with that. Maybe another advantage to a crate is that you when they're in a crate, you can put blankets over the crate.
Yeah.
You know, so again, it shows you another potential advantage to a crate is the ability to help your animal survive extreme conditions. So that I actually hadn't thought about that till just now, but I can see how that would be a huge advantage to you to be able to help maintain, you know, your animal's health.
And speaking about putting a blanket over, it's good for people too, and not to mention the cap.
Yep.
Warm caps are very good.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because we lose a lot of our heat through our head.
Yes.
So when you're trying to maintain body heat, cover your head. That's one of the most important lessons. I'm an outdoor survival guy. You know, I have taught some outdoor survival stuff, but mostly it's personal. And, you know, you have to learn how to maintain body heat when you're talking about outdoor survival.
Yes.
And, you know, we have a lot of different ways of doing that you know, we don't have all the blankets we have in a home. And, you know, how do you do that? You know, and you do it by creating Mother Nature's blankets, you know. But in your home, you've got all these blankets and you've got places to stay warm. If you are able to isolate a room so you can get in a smaller space, even body heat will help warm it. So the smaller the space you're either trying to heat or stay warm in, the easier it is for you to keep it warm and keep yourself warm. So blankets, clothes, cover your head. You know, if you need to, make sure to move, you know, generate a little heat, but not sweat. Because sweating is not a good thing, because then you'll, when that cools, you'll cool even faster. So, yeah, those are some of the survival tools that you can learn online if you want to look up survival. Put up a personal survival. And I know that you personally have talked about something and have some knowledge about, you know, even broader survival, like financial survival. And those are the some of the things that when you're looking maybe at the longer term and you decide you want to put a full plan together, that you need to consider as well, is, you know, what can you do to survive short-term, intermediate-term, or long-term disruptions to the financial system? Those are things that you should consider. The short-term ones play into what we're seeing this last week. Do I have access to my money? You know, that's an important part of being comfortable, you know, not just surviving, but being comfortable in your survival is, do I have access to my money? And that's something you should be planning for.
You know? Very well said. Yes. This is one of those things that it goes on, and it just depends on your level of comfort, the way I see it. Yes. Everyone has their own level of what they are comfortable with. But our job here, what I see is we can describe what might happen, and then every listener who hears this can decide where they personally stand in it. But it's good for us to advise for what we think, too, because we've seen the problems.
Yeah, and if you've looked at it and you've experienced it and lived it, I've been evacuated during the fires of 2008. My home was evacuated, so I've personally been affected by evacuation, and I've initiated many evacuations over the years as a firefighter and a fire chief officer directing fires. So I've helped manage them through the Emergency Operations Center, and I've seen the impacts that they have on people. And we do what we can to mitigate those impacts, to reduce the stress and take care of the physical needs of people during emergencies. But ultimately, our response system is somewhat dependent upon the fact that people have chosen to prepare for themselves.
That's good. And another thing that I am always trying to encourage people is water. Water is so easy to get that we often take it for granted. And if you are with water without water because a water line has broken, whether it's half a day or a day and a half, it changes your perspective a lot.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we've certainly experienced that in Paradise as well. Water disruption, service water, not that much. It's probably a little more reliable system than, say, our electrical system because of trees, primarily above ground power lines and trees, and the fact that water lines are in the ground. But we just had a significant water main get torn out of the ground during one of these recent storms and right near my home. And
a
tree went down and tore a water main out of the ground. And, you know, they had to, fortunately, had some workarounds and got all but a handful of people back on water right away. But, you know, those things can happen. And, you know, do you have a plan for that? I have, personally, I have probably just about every kind of water filtration, water treatment known to man, it seems like, in my arsenal. But that's partly because I used to own a store called Trailhead Adventures in Paradise, where we, so, you know, hiking and camping was our thing. And water, as you said, it's, you're, if you're hiking or backpacking, you know, you better take care of your water needs. So I always wanted to make sure I had backup to my water needs, and whether it be a survival straw that they make, where you can, you know, suck water through this filter straw and, you know, out of any water source, or a pump, or a pill that you can treat water with. You know, I've got them all, and I'm a great believer in hydration. So, you know, you need to keep your body hydrated. And I want to warn people that during stressful times, you need to really concentrate. You'll forget. You'll forget to do things like drink liquid. And that's when you need to drink liquid, because becoming dehydrated will cause you some other negative effects that you definitely don't want to have to deal with. I mean, it can cause you to not think as well, to be more fatigued. So, you know, you want to be sharp, drink your liquids.
Yeah. Do you like the idea of water, or would you put any additives to it?
I'm a water guy. I really am not that much of an additive guy. Mm-hmm. I carry some additives for in my day pack.
Yeah.
That could help if I was having a long-term issue. I'd start adding some of those additives. Primarily, you know, we're talking about electrolyte
yes,
type thing.
That's right.
But you know, I do have that with me. I rarely have used it. I have used it. I was in a summer situation where the hike took a lot longer than I thought. And we realized that we were going to be, you know, probably running out of our normal water supply. So as I got toward the end, I added some additive to it because I realized that would be a good way to make sure that I was covering my electrolyte needs. We were going through a lot of water. And, you know, you get caught. Summertime emergencies, again, that evacuation from wildland fires, for example, really points out the need to have water as part of your emergency kit.
Yeah.
Because you're losing a lot of fluid
yeah.
in just the normal day, and then you're being active and stressed, and dehydration becomes a real serious threat.
Yeah. And how about food? So often people think of food when they think of an emergency, but I know water's number one. What about food?
Yeah, well, you know, we have this rule of threes that they talk about, and it talks about, you know, 3 minutes of oxygen
yes.
and 3 hours of panic, meaning the 3 hours is sort of that period of, in which you either get control or don't get control when things go wrong. But then, you know, you can go for without water for 3 days, and you can go without food for 3 weeks. That said, that when we our carb level gets low, you know, our brain will not work as well.
Yes.
So although we can survive it without dying, you know, it's always good to have something that will allow you to replenish your carbs a little bit. So long term, you want a good healthy diet, but short term, you might need water and a granola bar. You know, so I always make sure in my day bags that I carry in my truck that I have water. I have a gallon of water, and then I have some individual waters mm-hmm. in my truck, and I have a water filter. But mm-hmm. I have water, and I also have energy bars.
And probably a sleeping bag.
And a sleeping bag, and yeah, and a knife, and you know, all of my normal supplies that I would have for different types of preparedness for what I might run into. I drive way up in the woods, mm-hmm. so I have a different level of survival gear in my truck than you would need to have necessarily evacuating from Oroville to Chico.
Yeah.
You know, I have toe straps and a come along and a shovel and, you know, because I might get stuck somewhere in the middle of nowhere. So that go bag, that's why we were talking about earlier, is the go bag's very individual, you know, to your needs.
And I'm so much in support of these ideas to examine and figure out what it is that you want to have. Everybody has their own desires, their own identifications for what the problem is and what the answers are. We just have about a minute left now. Is there anything that you'd like to add about any form of preparation or something to say to the community?
I just want to say thank you to our Butte County community more than anything else for the outpouring of care and concern and effort put into supporting the people who were displaced
yeah.
during the evacuation, our emergency responders, our emergency managers. My hat's off to you. I couldn't be prouder to be part of the community.
I join in that, both from the individual person, the citizenry, and the authorities, because the authorities did a great job too.
Absolutely.
And we still have to be aware for the future of anything. Mr. Jim Brochures, thank you very much for being on Christ Today.
Thank you for having me.